The next stage in our overview of the redemptive historical story of the Old Testament deals with the kingdom of Israel. First of all, with the rise of the monarchy, which was prompted by years of turmoil following Joshua's death. There had been a measure of unity among the tribes under the leadership of Moses and Joshua, but after them, with temporary exceptions, Israel's leaders were unable to unify in their God-given task of making their inheritance secure by completing the job of driving out their idolatrous neighbors. God's people started off well enough. Judges begins with them asking the Lord which tribe should take the lead in fighting the Canaanites. The Lord told them, Judah shall go up. And Judah did that and had some success, although they had some trouble overcoming the Canaanites of the plains because of their iron chariots. We don't know exactly what the men of Judah might have done differently. After all, the iron chariots of their enemies were a great advance on the weapons Judah had. But the main problem appears to have been a lack of will to fight on after Judah had conquered what they considered to be enough territory to sustain them. And the other tribes had similar problems. Judges 1 verse 21 tells us the Benjamites failed to dislodge the Jebusites. Verse 27, Manasseh did not drive out several groups of Canaanites. Other verses tell us, did Ephraim, Zebulun, Asher, Naphtali, or Dan. The failure of the tribes of Israel to drive out the nations as God had commanded led them to making agreements and treaties with the Canaanites. And that resulted in faith compromises. In fact, the major theme of the book of Judges is Israel's failure through compromise. God rebuked his people for their disobedience. The beginning of Judges chapter 2 tells us, the angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I brought you up out of Egypt and led you into the land that I swore to give to your forefathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall not make a covenant with the people of the land, but you shall break down their altars. Yet you have disobeyed me. Why have you done this? Now therefore I tell you, I will not drive them out before you. They will be thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you. Now most of these compromises took place after the death of the generation of Israelites who had personally experienced God's leading them into their inheritance. Judges 2, verses 10 to 15 says, after that whole generation had been gathered to their ancestors, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. There seems to have been a failure here of the parental generation to pass that on. And then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their ancestors, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples around them. They aroused the Lord's anger because they forsook him and served Baal and the Ashtoreths. In his anger against Israel, the Lord gave them into the hands of raiders who plundered them. He sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them. They were in great distress. And so again, the tragic story of the book of Judges is this: failure through compromise, a failure for which God judged the people of Israel. But he was not judging them in the sense of condemning them as he had the Canaanites. He was testing them, much as he had tested Israel in the wilderness to see if they would repent and follow him again. Judges chapter 2, verses 20 to 21 puts it this way, I will no longer, God says, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations Joshua left when he died. I will use them to test Israel, to see whether they will obey, the keep the way of the Lord and walk in it as their forefathers did. And this theme is repeated in chapter 3, verse 4. The nations were left to test the Israelites to see whether they would obey the Lord's command, which he had given their forefathers through Moses. This time of testing in the period of the judges lasted for about 300 years. Things were not as bad as they could have been, for God raised up a number of leaders during these years. 12 judges are mentioned in the book of Judges. They had some success at rescuing the people from their Canaanite oppressors and calling them back to the service of God and administering justice in the land. And still, there were long years between judges, and so these centuries were generally an unhappy time for Israel and for the demonstration of righteousness within the covenant community of Israel. There's a repetition in Judges, a series of what we might call vicious cycles that not only helps us understand what Israel went through, but also is informative about the ups and downs of life within any community of faith. God's people mess up time and again by departing from wholehearted devotion to God. And we know what inevitably follows such sinful compromise. Sooner or later, sin brings its own evil reward, some kind of suffering. Now, notice that I'm not saying that all suffering is a result of sin, but rather that all sin, sooner or later, results in suffering. This suffering often causes people to turn to God again and cry out for help. And of course, God responds to genuine prayer with help and salvation. And then after a while, it seems that people again start taking God for granted and neglecting him, and again start making unacceptable and sinful compromises. So to sum it up, we say that sin leads to suffering, which should lead to repentant supplication, which God answers with some sort of salvation. Sin, suffering, supplication, salvation. 6 times this pattern is made explicit in the book of Judges. The first time is listed in Judges 3, verses 7 to 11. The sin, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Asherahs. Suffering, the anger of the Lord turned against Israel so that he sold them into the hands of Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Aram-Naharaim, to whom the Israelites were subject for 8 years. Supplication, but when they cried out to the Lord, salvation, he raised up for them a deliverer, Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, who saved them. And so the land had peace for 40 years until Othniel, son of Kenaz, died. The second example is in the same chapter, verses 12 to 15. Sin, once again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Suffering. Because they did this evil, the Lord gave Eglon, king of Moab, power over Israel for 18 years. And prayer, supplication, again the Israelites cried out to the Lord, salvation, and he gave them a deliverer, Ehud, a left-handed man, the son of Gera, the Benjamite. Number 3 in Judges chapter 4. Sin, after Ehud died, the Israelites once again did evil in the eyes of the Lord. They suffered, so the Lord sold them into the hands of Jabin, the king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. In supplication, because he had 900 iron chariots and had cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years, they cried out to the Lord for help. And then salvation, Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was leading Israel at that time, and this period of peace lasted for 40 years. The fourth cycle in Judges 6 to 8, again the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. They sinned. And for 7 years, they suffered. He gave them into the hands of the Midianites. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help, supplication. This time, God answered their prayers with salvation by the hand of Gideon. And Judges 8, verse 28 concludes, Then Midian was subdued before the Israelites and did not raise its head again. During Gideon's lifetime, the land enjoyed peace 40 years. The fifth cycle in Judges 8, verse 33 to 12, verse 7. Sin. No sooner had Gideon died than the Israelites again prostituted themselves to the Baals. They set up Baal Berith as their god and did not remember the Lord their God, who had rescued them from the hands of all their enemies on every side. They also failed to show kindness to the family of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, for all the good things he had done for them. And because the Israelites forsook the Lord and no longer served him, they suffered. He became angry with them. He sold them into the hands of the Philistines and the Ammonites, who that year shattered and crushed them. For 18 years, they oppressed all the Israelites on the east side of the Jordan in Gilead, the land of the Amorites. Then, guess what? The Israelites cried out to the Lord, "We have sinned against you, forsaking our God and serving the Baals." And then salvation came at the hand of Jephthah, who came to the rescue and led Israel 6 years. And the final cycle is in Judges 13 through 16. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, this sad repetition. So the Lord delivered them into the hands, this time of the Philistines, for 40 years. Now, in this cycle, there is no mention of prayer or supplication. It's not explicit, but it certainly is implied. And then the angel of the Lord appeared to Samson's mother and told her the boy is to be a Nazarite, set apart to God from birth. And then God announced his salvation through Samson. He will begin the deliverance of Israel from the hands of the Philistines. And we find out later that deliverance, that period of deliverance, lasted for 20 years. Now, throughout this time, none of Israel's judges established dynasties. And Gideon had the best chance, but he wouldn't do it. The Israelites asked him to. They said, "Rule over us." Chapter 8, verse 22 and 23. "Your son, your grandson, because you have saved us out of the hand of Midian." But Gideon told them, "I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." Gideon had it right. He understood that Israel had been set up not as a monarchy, but as a theocracy, a nation under the direct rule of God. Tragically, however, after Gideon died, one of his 70 sons murdered all his brothers in an attempt to assume the power that had been offered to his father. All in all, Israel just didn't do well at passing the Lord's tests. At the best times, they still remembered that they were God's people and that they were supposed to be serving him. And I'm sure that even in the worst of times, there were always some faithful people of God. In fact, the book of Ruth speaks of some people during this time of the judges, the covenant-keeping actions of two people in particular in the time of the judges, and tells what their faithfulness meant to a woman named Naomi. Naomi had temporarily left the promised land with her husband and two sons, but after some time in Moab, her husband and sons died, and Naomi returned to her homeland feeling empty and hopeless. There, one of the faithful people who helped Naomi was Boaz, an Israelite, willing to risk his own future for the sake of caring for the down and out of his world and of his people. The other person who helped in this regard was Naomi's daughter-in-law, Ruth. Now, Ruth was a Moabite, a newcomer to the worship of Yahweh, who had accompanied Naomi back to Israel despite her lack of prospects there. Both Boaz and Ruth conducted themselves just as God wanted his people to do. And as a result, they got married, and as a result of the son born to them, Naomi regained her inheritance in Israel and was brought, as she described it, from emptiness to fullness. this fullness in the person of the son of Ruth and Boaz would eventually bless the entire nation through his grandson, who was David. The story of Ruth and Boaz, however, appears to have been somewhat unusual for the period of the Judges. The last verse of the whole book of Judges summarizes the period like this: in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. In fact, that statement is made a few more times in Judges. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. Despite their unfaithfulness, however, God was persevering with his people to maintain the promise he had first made to Abraham. He was determined to see this project through to the end. God's next steps are recounted in 1 Samuel. As the name of the book indicates, Samuel is a central character in this story. He was the last and probably best judge of Israel. Samuel was different right from the start. To start with, he was born to a special woman, Hannah, who had been barren for many years, considered to be a tragedy in Israel, where barren women were considered to be cursed. In her desperation, Hannah vowed to the Lord that if he would only bless her with a son, she would surrender him into the Lord's service. Shortly afterward, she was enabled to conceive, and 9 months later, Samuel was born. How happy Hannah was. But she didn't forget her vow to dedicate him to the Lord. And so after Samuel was weaned, probably at about age 3 or 4, she took him to Shiloh to live with and be trained by Eli the priest. Now, conditions in Eli's home were not the best. Actually, what happened there was typical of what was happening at large in Israel, with everyone doing his own thing. Eli's sons, who were also priests, didn't even let the people sacrifice properly. They confiscated the fat of the offerings for themselves, and that's significant because in biblical terms, the fat was the best portion and reserved for God alone. For this offense and others, God sent a prophet to Eli to announce judgment on his house. But even in this atmosphere, God was with Samuel and already early in his life spoke to him and through him. 1 Samuel verse 3, or chapter 3, verse 19 to 20 puts it this way, a couple of verses: the Lord was with Samuel as he grew up, and he let none of Samuel's words fall to the ground. What a beautiful a way of saying that he supported what Samuel said. And Samuel was clear to say only what God told him to say. And so all Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, recognized that Samuel was attested as a prophet of the Lord. Samuel's judgeship was accompanied by a degree of relief from Philistine oppression. But later on, Israel grew concerned for what would happen when Samuel was gone. He appointed his sons as Israel's leaders, but they had turned out rather like Eli's sons, accepting bribes and perverting justice. And so the elders of Israel asked Samuel to appoint a king to lead them. We can probably understand that request for a king. All the surrounding nations had kings, and the elders thought it would solve Israel's many problems and make things wonderfully easier. If only Samuel's successor could be a human, invisible king, such as the neighboring peoples had. But that was not in mind what God had in mind for his people. God had wanted a theocracy, direct rule by himself. He himself was Israel's king, invisible. Samuel knew this and was angered by the request of Israel's elders, but God told him not to take the rejection personally. He also told Samuel to warn Israel how much the king would demand of them, things like heavy taxes, forced labor, military service. But 1 Samuel 8, verse 18 says, they refused to listen. The people refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said, we want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and go out before us and fight our battles. And so God gave in and led Samuel to anoint Saul as Israel's first king. Saul was an impressive man physically, taller than everyone else, and he started off at least as an apparently God-fearing and humble man. Unfortunately, it didn't take him long before he demonstrated his unwillingness to follow God's instructions. The occasion was a threat from a large force of Philistines who had much of Israel's army hiding in fear, and others even deserting. Saul had been told to wait for Samuel to offer the pre-battle sacrifices, but after a week of waiting, the king took upon himself to do what only the priests were authorized to do. Shortly after, Samuel showed up and severely rebuked Saul, telling him that for his disobedience, his kingship would not endure. Sometime later, Israel was in a battle with the Amalekites, and Saul disobeyed the Lord again, this time in his failure to totally destroy this nation and all their possessions. God had put them under the ban of final judgment for the ambush that they had set against the Israelites as they made their way from Egypt to the Promised Land. After that battle, Moses had spoken this word from the Lord, Exodus 17, verse 16, "Because hands were lifted up against the throne of the Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation." Samuel told Saul what his disobedience meant. He said, "You have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you as king over Israel." It was the last time Samuel would ever go to see Saul. And soon after, he anointed David as Saul's successor. From this time on, Saul deteriorated even more spiritually. His low point came the day before his death, when he resorted to a pagan practice that he himself had previously outlawed. He went to a spiritual medium to consult with spirits of the dead. The next day, Israel's army was defeated by the Philistines, and Saul and his three sons died in the battle, Saul by suicide. Before this end, however, Saul's decline was associated with the story of the rise of David, who would succeed him to the throne. To this point, the Lord's negative predictions about the appointment of a king for Israel were confirmed. And yet God would raise up a king who had a heart for him and his purposes, David. And even though David would have his significant failures, God would keep covenant with David's line and make sure of an eventual successor who would live, die, and be raised again to be the perfect king for the spiritual offspring of Abraham.